From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Is gun control a dead issue? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Since the deadly mass shooting in Tucson, three high school students have been shot near Los Angeles, and a gunman killed two police officers in Miami. But there's been little support for new gun controls in Washington or anyplace else. President Obama and the White House aides have avoided the issue. In the past, such high-profile incidents have led to restrictions, but times have changed. Have Democrats lost their nerve? Has the NRA won the battle? We'll hear from pollsters, reporters, the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence, and the world's biggest gun trade show going on now in Las Vegas. On Reporter's Notebook later on, is Bradley Manning being abused? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. Gun violence has made recent headlines, most conspicuously in Tucson and in other cities as well. But there's no new debate about restrictions on deadly weapons. We'll talk about gun rights, victims' rights, and increased concerns about the intrusive powers of government. On Reporter's Notebook, Army PFC Bradley Manning is accused of passing thousands of classified documents to WikiLeaks, which made them public. As a man who has not been convicted, been abused during 6 months in military custody. First, this news update. Jeffrey Immelt, the CEO of General Electric, will succeed Paul Volcker as one of President Obama's principal economic advisors. The Economic Recovery Advisory Board will now be called the Council on Jobs and Competitiveness. Here's the president appraising GE at a plant in Schenectady.
We were spending a lot on credit cards. Everybody was borrowing a lot. Chinese were selling a lot to us. Folks were selling a lot to us from all over the world. We've got to reverse that. We want an economy that's fueled by what we invent and what we build. We're going back to Thomas Edison's principles. We're going to build stuff and invent stuff.
Daniel Indiviglio is associate editor of The Atlantic Magazine. Good to have you back on our program.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Sound like a campaign speech.
A little bit.
What about the CEO of Jeffrey Immelt? There's already some criticism coming from the president's base that he's trying to snuggle up to big business.
Well, there's definitely okay, let's start with the fact that, first of all, clearly he's very qualified to talk about creating jobs and economic policy and that sort of thing. I mean, he's the CEO of GE. He's one of the smartest guys out there, to be sure, right? The problem, however, is he's going to remain CEO of GE during this time. This is sort of a part-time gig for Immelt. He's going to maintain the same duties he had before at GE, which really presents something of a conflict of interest. As he gives Obama various advice about how to fix the economy, you have to wonder how much his position is going to skew the kind of advice he gives.
What do you mean by that? Do you think that he will try to secure advantages with his relationship to the president for his company?
Well, I certainly can't say exactly what he'll do, because who knows. But in general, you would think that if people are worried about a conflict of interest that someone who once worked at an investment bank would have if advising the treasurer, that sort of thing, for sure, if someone still actually works for that company, it's going to be very hard for them to be unbiased when trying to figure out policies that would be best for the U.S. economy. So it's hard to say, but it certainly doesn't look promising.
Has the White House responded at all to questions about that, or is it too early?
I would imagine, I haven't heard any specific responses, but I would imagine that they would simply look to Immelt's qualifications. And it is important also to note, he will be influential here, but he won't be a regulator. He won't actually have any rulemaking power, that sort of thing. It's just more a matter of influence and the fact that he'll be able to be very close to the president and to have a lot of say on the sorts of things that the president does champion.
What about the concern that GE has been an exporter of jobs?
Well, that's interesting to know, too. That's also a big complaint about GE, and obviously that's not something the president wants to see happen. So I don't know. It'll be curious to see how Immelt would respond to those kind of issues.
Interestingly, Scott Paul from the Alliance for American Manufacturing is one of those who raised that point, coming from an odd source, you would think.
Yeah.
Immelt himself wrote an op-ed page, had published an op-ed page in the Washington Post today, with three priorities. They were manufacturing, trade, and innovation. How do those three strengthen your concern about the conflict of interest? How does that work?
Well, the third certainly doesn't. I mean, the idea that innovation is important is sort of an Econ 101 concept, right? Everybody knows innovation is important for an economy to move forward. Manufacturing and trade may indeed be important tools to create jobs. However, they also happen to precisely coincide with GE's business, right? I mean, they're big on manufacturing, and they're a global company that trades all over the world. So, you know, we're already starting to see a taste of the kind of thing that obviously Immelt would care about if he's looking out for GE's best interest.
Some of the progressives are complaining, apparently, that this appointment of Jeffrey Immelt is really about getting corporate contributions for the upcoming presidential campaign. I suppose that's an element as well.
Well, I hope not to be that cynical, but I mean, if you look at GE's past and even the kind of things Immelt has said, he's come out quite unabashedly about the fact that GE and other large companies need to have a cozy relationship with Washington in order to get things done. In this day and age, it's just a practical matter, he said, that that relationship's important. So there's no kind of imagination here that Immelt knows what he's getting into and that he's got to be excited to have this sort of influence.
On the other hand, as you point out in your story today, it's not exactly unusual for corporate leaders to play this kind of role.
That's right. These sorts of panels often exist. The question is, though, the leadership, right, he's actually going to chair the committee. He was actually on Volcker's committee before for the past 2 years when it was about solving the financial crisis issues, and now he's moving up to heading the committee. So he had influence before, and it's just a question of how great that influence is becoming and if it's too much.
Okay, we shall see what this means in the future. Do you think there would be anything specific very soon?
It'll probably take a little time for them to come out with anything, but before too long, I'm sure we'll see some recommendations on how to create jobs.
Okay, Daniel Indiviglio, Associate Editor of Atlantic Magazine. Thanks, as always, for being on our program.
Sure, thank you.
In a moment, is gun control a dead issue? On To The Point.
To The Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Alney back with To The Point. In the past, mass murder and the killings and attempted killings of public figures have led to restrictions on guns. But recently, even those incidents that have worked their way into the language, Columbine, the D.C. sniper, Virginia Tech, have not. The deadly shootings in Tucson produced a week of national mourning and a speech by the President of the United States, but no sense of public urgency about gun control. James Grimaldi has written about the issue for The Washington Post. James, good to have you back on our program.
Thanks for inviting me.
In a recent article, you began it by saying the road to firearms policy in America is paved in blood. What did you mean by that?
Well, you look at all the laws passed in the United States, they're usually tied to some major events, like the assassination of John F. Kennedy was the precursor to the Gun Control Act. But it took a number of years after that assassination before the Gun Control Act was passed. In 1968, we had the assassinations of Robert F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. That preceded that. But if you even go back further than that, the first Federal Firearms Act in the 30s came from the bloodshed with the wars with Elliot Ness and Prohibition. That was sort of a response to that. But Gun Control Act of 68 is really the baseline law that we look at today.
And again, that was the year that both Robert F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. were assassinated.
That's right. And in fact, when you look at the specifics of the law, there are even a few things in there that refer back to the John F. Kennedy assassination. For example, if you've renounced your citizenship or you've been dishonorably discharged from the military services, you're prohibited from buying a gun from a licensed federal firearm dealer. And that, of course, was because Oswald had done both of those things. The other limitations are the felons and drug users, the basically mentally insane, or those who have been adjudicated mental defective, is the language, are also prohibited from buying guns.
What about the shooting in 1981 that wounded Ronald Reagan and his press secretary, or excuse me, yeah, and his press secretary, James Brady?
Well, there really wasn't much for about 14 years or so until the Brady Law was passed. And in fact, in the Reagan administration, there was a law that loosened gun restrictions. It was called the Gun Owners Protection Act that passed in 1986. The Brady Law established the background check. Initially, there was a delay period to get the check done, but there was a push to make it instantaneous, and about 4 years later, by about 1998, the checks were instantaneous, and they pretty much are so today.
So what's happened since? What about Columbine and the D.C. sniper and Virginia Tech?
Well, for Columbine and the D.C. sniper, not much. Virginia Tech did have a change. It prompted the what they called the NICS Improvement Act of 2007. That's the National Instant Background Check System that was established under the Brady Law. What happened was Mr. Cho, who was the shooter at Virginia Tech, had been adjudicated as one who was a mental defective under the law, but he'd not been reported to the NICS database, which is maintained by the FBI in West Virginia. And this law provided some financial incentives for the states to encourage them to report those who are ineligible under the law to be able to purchase a firearm. And obviously, it might have had some impact on that particular case, because Cho went to a federal firearm licensee, a gun store in Roanoke, I believe, to purchase his weapons, and made the background check.
So there have been, then, some increases in gun control, but it would appear that the 1994 assault weapons ban was a sort of watershed in this regard.
Right. The assault weapons ban was sunsetted in 2004. It was a 10-year law, and there's some question about its effectiveness. We're actually working on a story for the weekend in the Washington Post that will take a look at the only database that may actually look at one provision of that law. There's a move in Congress to put a limit on the magazine capacity so that you can't have these spree killings. In the case of the Tucson shooting, the shooter there had a 31-bullet magazine, was able to fire off 31 bullets or so prior to being subdued, and he was subdued while trying to change the magazine. The sense is, if you limit the sales of these high-capacity magazines, maybe you'll prevent a lot of bloodshed in a spree shooting. And we've actually done a little examination of the capacity, which we're going to show, I think, during that assault weapons ban. There was a decline in the number of guns in this particular database, decline in the number of guns seized by police with high-capacity magazines.
I have to say that legislation that's been proposed now is from the Democratic Representative Carolyn McCarthy from New York, whose husband was killed in a mass murder on the Long Island Railroad in New York about 17 years ago, and her son was injured. I believe he is still paralyzed. Again, James Grimaldi is an investigative reporter for The Washington Post. Michael Dimmock is Associate Director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. Michael Dimmock, good to have you on our show.
Thanks for having me.
You've done some research on gun control and public support or lack of support for it. What do you see?
Well, there's been a shift in the balance of the general public's views on gun control. About 4 years ago or so, you had, by 2-1, more people saying the priority should be placed on controlling gun ownership rather than protecting the rights of Americans to own guns. Now that's become pretty much a 50-50 split. You have a rise in the number who think that protecting gun rights is a larger priority, and a decline in the proportion who prioritize gun control.
What reason do you think there is for this?
Well, a lot of the shift happened in 2009, and around the early part of the Obama administration. There's a pretty good segment of Americans who are very consistently in favor of gun control, a pretty good share that are consistently in favor of gun rights. And then there's a bigger middle of the electorate who you know, probably sees both arguments, is going to draw the line in different places with different kinds of restrictions, and is probably not following the issue very closely, and is reacting to other things they're observing in politics. They're seeing an era where government is doing more, expanding more, and is perhaps just, you know, siding more on the side of individual rights rather than government control because of what they think is a broader trend.
Have you been able to poll since Tucson?
We have, yes. And we saw very little change from our most recent poll in September of 2010. We saw really no significant change in the balance of opinion following the Tucson shootings. And that's not that unusual. As James Grimaldi pointed out, you see some legislative action after some of the violent events that have guns involved, but you don't often see substantial or long-lasting shifts in public opinion as a result of these kinds of events.
Why not? Why is it that people don't revolt against guns?
Well, I think that in this case, the main factor is that the vast majority of the public doesn't think this issue is linked to the gun control issue. When we ask people whether this reflected a broader social problem or was just an isolated event of basically a crazy person, that's what they think it was. And there are a lot of other polls that have shown that very few Americans think that gun control laws or stricter gun control laws would have done much to prevent a person like this from taking the actions he took.
Who are the people that support gun rights? Ask it a different way. Who are the people that support gun control?
Well, there's a big gender divide on the gun issue, and most women favor gun control, most men favor gun rights, and that's probably one of the biggest divides. There's also a racial and ethnic divide. Whites tend to favor gun rights, and minority groups, both Black and Latino, tend to be more supportive of gun control in general. There's very little difference by education or age. Those are not big factors that divide in terms of this issue.
Education or age don't make a difference. So experience of presidential assassinations, for example, then it doesn't seem to last.
Right. No, I mean, folks who are 50 and over, 65 and over, are no more supportive of gun control than folks who are under 30.
What about partisan affiliation?
Well, that's obviously a very big divide. I mean, Democrats by well over 2-1 favor gun control, and Republicans by nearly 3-1 favor protecting gun rights.
Okay. Again, we're talking with Michael Dimmock, who's Associate Director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. In his speech in Tucson, President Obama did mention the issue of gun safety, said that it's a good thing to have a national conversation about it. But he stayed a long way from a proposal for action. Here's what he said.
We cannot and will not be passive in the face of such violence. We should be willing to challenge old assumptions in order to lessen the prospects of such violence in the future.
Susan Davis is congressional correspondent for National Journal. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
If the president's not calling for any kind of major action at this point, what's going on in the Congress?
On gun control?
Yeah.
I mean, you have seen a handful of members come forward after Tucson, one being Congresswoman McCarthy from New York, who offered a bill that she offers every Congress, a gun control measure. Peter King, a Republican from New York, offered a bill that would prohibit people from carrying weapons within 1,000 feet of lawmakers. Louie Gohmert, a Republican from Texas, had suggested that he would introduce a bill that would allow members of Congress to carry firearms on their person when they are in Washington, D.C. at the Capitol. As you know, there's currently restrictions on handguns in the Capitol. So we've seen an element of – there's proposals out there, but I think that there is also an understanding that there's probably no real legislative action going to occur when it comes to guns.
How do you see this history?
Excuse me?
How do you see the history of this? Since, for example, 1994, we've talked about whether various incidents have made a difference. What happened in 1994 that seems to have had an impact on Democrats particularly?
Well, 1994 was when the assault weapons ban became law, and it was a very contentious political debate. And I think that people that were involved in the debate in 1994, President Clinton among them, really credited that gun bill with what helped sweep Democrats out of power that year. It was very heavily opposed by critical voting blocs, in particular white men, a critical swing voting bloc at the time. So I think it was a bit of a politically scarring experience for Democrats, who the party itself in the past, you know, I guess it's been almost 17 years since the law has passed, has really walked away from the gun issue. And I think that the gun control or gun rights advocates have, on the right, have maintained a very strong presence, and on the left, they sort of walked away from the table. Now, there's still a certain amount of interest groups that do advocate for gun control measures, but they have nowhere near the authority or the political weight as the opposing side.
So the Democrats, you say, are walking away. Do you see the results of the Pew survey that we just heard a bit about from Michael Dimmock as an opportunity for the Democrats?
Yes, but here's what's really interesting. So in 1994, the lessons of this was that if you push gun control measures, the swing voting blocs, particularly white men and in rural areas, are going to walk away from the party. So over the course of the past 16 years, Democrats have really stayed away from the issue. But in those same 16 years, those exact same voters have left the Democratic Party anyway. So you have been left with a Democratic Party that its foundation at this point is now women, minorities, young people, and college-educated voters, all four subset of voters who are, as the Pew poll indicates, the most inclined to support gun control measures. And geographically, which is another really interesting part of the gun debate, is where you live is where you often how you see the issue, not just who you are. And the Democratic Party has become much more of an urban, suburban party, which is exactly where people live in those places are much more inclined, whereas rural and ex-urban areas, which tend to be more conservative, but Democrats aren't there anyway. So there's a political argument that you could make that if there was any kind of appetite to really take up this issue, that they have a willing coalition behind them that could support them and perhaps help them in certain races. But you just don't see, outside of the usual suspects that normally talk about gun control issues, there's really no champion of the issue and no willingness there, no one on the horizon that seems like they're willing to step into that spotlight.
Michael Dimmock with the Pew Research Center, we need to go to a break very soon, but I'm just interested in your take on that. Do you think that Susan Davis is right? If the Democrats started advocating gun control again, would that be seen favorably by this willing coalition that she described?
I think she's right. I mean, a lot of the issues have become increasingly aligned into the bases, whether it's social issues, civil liberties issues, economic issues. And so there is much more, you know, sort of similarity across those issues. I think the big question is making it a priority. I mean, does an event like this change the importance of the issue more on one side or the other of the debate? Is there really a fire and a desire to see action on the issue within that base that makes this an appealing issue? Typically, the energy has been on the other side, on the gun rights side, and it's not clear that this event is going to change that.
Okay, we'll continue this conversation after a brief break. On a reporter's notebook, the Navy's treatment of a soldier accused of passing secrets to WikiLeaks. Back in a moment with To the Point.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. In the aftermath of Tucson and other incidents as well, we're talking about the prospects for gun control, which, as we've heard on our program, is something that the Democrats used to espouse but now seem to have walked a bit away from. That, of course, applying to the president as well as members of Congress. Is there now a possibility for there to be more energy on the gun control side because of the demographics and who it is that still supports the idea of a gun control? Paul Helmke is president of the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be on.
You've conceded that there hasn't been a lot of support for gun control now for quite some time. Do you see any opportunity in what Susan Davis has had to say?
Yeah, clearly I think that this time it's going to be different. First of all, it was a member of Congress that was attacked. That doesn't happen very often in this country. Secondly, this guy didn't break any laws until he pulled the trigger. Usually the other side says, oh, let's just enforce the laws on the books. The laws on the books are so weak that this person was able to do everything legally till he put the first bullet into the congresswoman's brain. And really, it's because we don't have any laws in the books. The third thing is that you can tie it to a specific thing, this extended high-capacity clip. If that had been banned, which it had been banned for 10 years, and by 2004 it was hard to find these clips, he would have only gotten 10 shots off instead of 10 or 11 shots off instead of 31 or 32. When people are asked specifically in a poll about specific measures, they answer in supportive of numbers at a much higher rate than the general question. For example, the Washington Post just had a poll the other day, said, do you support tighter restrictions on guns? 52% said yes. But when asked about a specific question, do you support banning these high-capacity clips? 58% said yes. The Mayors Against Illegal Guns, the group led by Mayor Bloomberg from New York, did a poll just last week that found that 58% support banning these high-capacity ammunition magazines, 66% support requiring gun owners to register each gun, 89% say they want background checks on all sales at gun shows. So when you're asked about a specific thing, then you get support. I think a lot of people think that the word gun control might mean gun ban, and that's not something we're pushing for, that's not something that's been talked about, and that's not something that's even constitutional since the D.C. versus Heller and McDonald versus Chicago cases. So I think there is a different mood here for a number of those reasons.
Those cases where the U.S. Supreme Court recently overturned bans on handguns.
That's correct. And it's my hope after those cases was really that this could help move the debate forward. In effect, they said the extremes were off the table. You can't have near-total gun bans, but you can't have this idea that anyone can have any gun and take it anywhere at any time. And I really think that once we start focusing on the fact that we have a problem, 30,000 people killed every year with guns, another 70,000 people injured every year with guns, that there are things that are constitutional that can make it harder for dangerous people to get guns, I think we're going to see action. Just in the last couple of days, today Peggy Noonan's got a column in the Washington Post saying that one of the things Obama ought to talk about in the State of the Union is restrictions on these high-capacity clips. She says, Republicans aren't going to go to the wall to let somebody get 31 rounds off in 15 seconds, and this would be showing some leadership. Dick Cheney said we should start looking at this. The fellow that financed the D.C. Heller case says this would be constitutional. So it's we need the American people to let their elected officials know that, this is common sense, this is law and order. I was a Midwestern Republican mayor of Fort Wayne, Indiana for 12 years. I came to this issue as a law and order issue because I saw too many people getting killed in my city in the late 80s and early 90s, and I realized how weak the gun laws were. And I think that's what we're going to start seeing more of. By the way, U.S. Conference of Mayors just today adopted a resolution, and that's a bipartisan group across the country, adopted a resolution saying we need to support McCarthy's bill to ban these high-capacity clips, and we need a stronger background check system to stop dangerous people like the Tucson shooter.
Paul Helmke again, the president of the Brady Center to Prevent Handgun Violence. In Las Vegas, Nevada right now, the SHOT Show is going on. That's the world's largest gun trade show. Alan Gottlieb is there. He's the founder of the Second Amendment Foundation. That's a national pro-gun rights organization. Mr. Gottlieb, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure to be with you.
What do you say to what we just heard, and particularly to Peggy Noonan, a former speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush, and Dick Cheney says that we ought to restrict these clips? How do you feel about it?
Well, I don't think Dick Cheney actually said we ought to restrict the clips. I think you ought to talk more about the general issue as a whole on who should be able to have them, maybe, and who shouldn't.
Okay.
What's really interesting with this is that, look at the other side of the equation. Guns save lives. How many people use these clips or use firearms to protect themselves, their family, and their property from criminal attack? Paul Helmke and others will talk about people that die in gun violence, and none of us want to see that, but they totally ignore the other end of the equation. You can't get a good policy answer to a question without looking at both sides of the equation. And that's something that the gun control advocates never want to look at or never want to discuss.
Are there examples that you can cite where people have used these magazines with that shoot so many bullets in such a short time to protect themselves?
Well, there have been a number of cases in Arizona, the same state that this terrible incident happened in, where against drug dealers and illegal aliens and traffickers, where people along the border have used firearms with large capacity clips to protect themselves, currently going on. It makes lots of press in Arizona. It just doesn't seem to make lots of press nationally. Here in Las Vegas at the SHOT Show, it's really kind of interesting because we have like a record attendance of like 55,000 people that have attended it. It's one of the biggest trade shows in Las Vegas in any trade or industry. But what's interesting is that since everybody's been screaming for more gun control, what we've seen is more firearms are being sold and more ammunition is being sold. So screams have other unintended consequences. So lots of people in the gun control debate should stop and realize when they do this, what happens is they sell lots of guns and lots of ammunition. A good example was when the assault weapon ban was passed and these so-called clips were banned, any manufacturer that had inventory of these before the law was passed was allowed to sell those. And about a 10-year supply of those clips were sold in 1 year. So when everybody talks about how that assault weapon ban may have taken these clips off the market, the fact is they didn't. They accelerated them onto the market. There's a lot of unintended consequences that gun control people don't realize.
What do you think is going to happen in Congress? Do you disagree then with Peggy Noonan that Republicans won't try to advocate that people have these automatic weapons? Or excuse me, the clips, not the weapons.
I knew what you meant.
I'm sure you did.
No, I don't think you're going to see any legislation passed in Congress at all. One of the things that bothers me about the situation that happened in Arizona is the perpetrator of this crime had two drug crimes being deferred for prosecution. If he was prosecuted for those drug crimes, he would have been an habitual drug user and would have been prohibited from walking into the gun store and buying the gun. So when Paul Helfke and others say that the current laws on the books don't work and we need more, and gun rights advocates people say that just enforce the laws, here's a case where the law really wasn't enforced because the judicial system let everybody down by letting this person out on the street to buy a gun when he should have been a prohibited individual.
So you think then there's going to be enough opposition to the idea of limiting the clips or banning the clips that it won't go anywhere in Congress?
I guarantee it that in this session of Congress it's going nowhere.
Paul Helmke, back to you with the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Were you talking when you said there's a good chance for this about this session of Congress or future ones?
If the world worked the way it was supposed to, it would be this session of Congress. I know that doesn't always happen. If the president would talk about this in the State of the Union or talk about the issue in the State of the Union, I think it would help give a profile to it. If the American people started contacting their legislators, asking them to do this, I think it could pass. Again, it's hard to make a defense for these high-capacity clips. They're not used for hunting. They're not used for personal protection. If you can't stop the bad guy with 10 bullets, you're either dead or they've run away. And the only thing these high-capacity clips are good for are killing and injuring a lot of people very quickly. This guy got off 32 rounds in 15 seconds. And, it's not necessary. I'd love to see a debate on this and to see what kind of arguments they come up with. Well, they're not going to have any good arguments.
Well, Alan Gottlieb claims that in Arizona, southern Arizona, along the border there, that these clips have been used by people to defend themselves. What do you say?
Well, I've never seen those stories unless it's one drug gang fighting another drug gang. And in terms of the drug laws, this guy was only in the court system once with regard to a drug law, and that was drug paraphernalia, and it was a diversion thing. And if we're going to start not diverting, that's another issue. You know, one thing I point out to people, since 1968, it's said that if you're addicted to or a user of a controlled substance, you should be banned. There's not really a good way to test that the way we do felony records and mentally dangerous records. You know, unless Alan wants to start requiring drug tests for all sales, and we might be willing to get on that legislation.
Alan Gottlieb, what do you say to that?
Well, I think there's significant court records of people who are drug users and get deferred and get sent over for treatment or whatever, but there's no reason why those records are not reported so they go into the NICS system so those people can't go be buying firearms. There's a way to do this and protect civil liberties of the general public at the same time. Paul Helmke doesn't seem to care about civil liberties.
Back to the issue of people actually using the clips that allow the firing of multiple bullets to protect themselves. Can you be more specific? You said there were some incidents in Arizona. Is there one that you can name or two that you can name where they were used in that manner?
Well, there was one back in November where a rancher and his wife actually used two semi-automatic firearms with large capacity clips to protect himself against a bunch of illegal aliens and smugglers coming across the border through their property, were armed and they needed to protect themselves. These things happen all the time. A significant number of semi-automatic handguns hold magazines that clips of 15 rounds. Well, McCarthy's ban, Congresswoman McCarthy wants to ban them above 10. It would make inoperable a significant number of firearms that exist. Now, Paul Helmke referenced that the attorneys for the Heller decisions that it would be constitutional to ban these. But he also said it would be bad public policy. So some things that are constitutional don't mean that it's good public policy to do.
Paul Helmke, back to you with the Brady Center. It's been apparently that there's a record that of the fact that when gun control is talked about, more people go out and buy guns. That mm-hmm. happened when President Obama was elected. He who has not done much on the issue in office, but prior to being in office as president, he was very much in favor of gun control. Are you worried that your advocacy might be self-defeating?
It's the gun manufacturers, the gun dealers look for any reason they can to sell more guns, sell more ammunition, and make more money. The NRA spent $15 million in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Indiana to try to defeat Obama in those states. When they failed, I thought, boy, that shows the NRA's gotten weaker. But gun sales went up, so I realized really they weren't as much trying to affect the election as they were trying to make more money for the people that fund them. And, you know, people on the other side make money off of this. We represent the victims. We represent the law enforcement that responds to these things. Alan's point about the high-capacity clips, yes, they're being bought now, but if they're banned, people are going to run out of them after a while. And in 1994, it was the same argument. People went out and got the high-capacity clips, and through the 90s, they were still out there, but by 2004, they'd gone away. If Glock isn't making these high-capacity magazines anymore, if other people aren't making them anymore, I don't think the bad guys are going to sit around in their basements producing these things. You're going to see less of them, and that means there's going to be less lethality. There was an earlier discussion about political assassinations and how it drove things. Think back. When Robert Kennedy was assassinated, he was the only person hit in that back part of the Ambassador Hotel. When George Wallace was paralyzed in 1972, he was the only person hit. These used to be a one shot and you're done. In this day and age, because we are now promoting these high-capacity clips and these semi-automatics that can get all these rounds out, and that's only been something that's happened since the late 70s, now we're seeing every shooting, whether it's a political assassination attempt or just something like Columbine, something like Virginia Tech, something like the business shooting in Connecticut recently, you're seeing a lot more people being killed because a lot more bullets are flying.
So, Mr. Gottlieb, once again, with the Second Amendment Foundation, isn't it a lot more likely that there will be collateral damage if you have a clip that allows so many bullets to be shot so fast?
It might be true that there could be collateral damage. One doesn't know. The question is, who do you want to have the right to make the choice about what weapon they use or how they defend themselves? I don't want the government telling me how I defend myself. I have my right on how I choose to defend myself. And that's the difference between Paul Helmke and myself. The trick is to keep guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them, keep them off the streets to begin with, rather than spending all of our time, money, and resources trying to regulate 100% of society when all those resources get spent in the wrong direction. That's why gun control is doomed to failure. A person who is bent on creating murder or rape or robbery is already breaking some pretty severe laws that are out there. If you pass another gun control law or another gun ban or ban on clips or magazines, do you really think those kind of people are going to abide by that? A great example is the shooter in Arizona. He drove up right to the rally in his car in the parking lot. If he didn't use a gun, but he took his car and stepped on the gas, he might have been able to kill a lot more people in the crowd just using his automobile. So you don't stop nuts like this from doing damage to people. The trick is to try to keep them off the street to begin with.
Let me go back to our other guest, James Grinaldi, still with us, investigative reporter for The Washington Post. Do you know anything about these incidents in Arizona where Mr. Gottlieb alleges that people defended themselves successfully with semi-automatic weapons that had clips with a lot of bullets in them?
No, I don't know much about that, but I will say I think he's right that the issue is probably dead in this particular Congress. And part of the reason is that for Democrats to have control of, for example, the House, they're really reliant upon rural Democrats who have good records with the NRA. If you look at all the rural Democrats who lost, people like Ike Skelton in Missouri, you'll see that they had very good NRA ratings, and I think the only way, and Nancy Pelosi knows this, they hold the House is if they've got pro-gun Democrats. And second, the Obama administration cannot even get a director confirmed for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, which is the agency that enforces our federal firearm laws. If he can't even get a director of the ATF confirmed, I guess I'm dubious that he will even come out or talk about this other issue. It would be interesting. Right now, there's a rule, an emergency rule, that Obama is is we're waiting to hear from the Office of Management and Budget, which is the White House, whether they will approve an emergency rule to deal with the border issue and guns going to Mexico. Right now, that rule has not been approved, and there's questions about whether or not it will be approved. So there are other either larger or smaller issues you might want to take a look at that are more imminent in some ways than this proposal from Congresswoman McCarthy.
Susan Davis, your congressional reporter for the National Journal. You said earlier that the kinds of people that the Democrats might lose if they proposed gun control are already gone, and that there might be a willing coalition large enough to get something passed. What if the president were to use this issue and promote this issue in his State of the Union message? Do you think that would make a difference in Congress?
I do. I do not. There's nothing that we've seen so far that suggests that the White House is considering that. But I would say that there's nothing on the congressional side that suggests that they're going to take up any kind of gun issue in this Congress. The only thing that could potentially give it any kind of momentum is if the president does, as Peggy Noonan had suggested in her column and other people have suggested, if he used that platform to make a case for some form of gun control measure. I don't know what that would be, maybe the magazine clip issue that Noonan had referenced in her column. That would give it, that would get national pickup. I think that there would be a national focus on it. I think that would give some momentum to Congress. But if it doesn't come from the president of the State of the Union, I think it's all but flatlined.
Paul Helmkley, do you agree with that?
It's going to take leadership from the top, and it's going to take pressure from the bottom, and I'm hoping we can get it. In the past, for example, in the late 80s, they banned plastic guns that don't show up in the metal detectors. They banned cop killer bullets. Only a handful of Congress people voted against those, including Dick Cheney, by the way. But if this is seen as something that really is outside the scope of the Second Amendment debate, the traditional gun debate, the president can help that happen, but hopefully we'll be pushing everything we can, and the American people need to do that, too.
Okay, that's all the time we have for this one. Thank you all very much for being with us. Paul Helmke, former mayor of Fort Wayne, Indiana, now president of the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Susan Davis with the National Journal. Michael Dimmock, our earlier guest with the Pew Research Center. And James Grimaldi, investigative reporter for the Washington Post. Thanks, too, to Alan Gottlieb, founder of the Second Amendment Foundation, talking to us from the SHOT Show in Las Vegas, the world's largest gun trade show. He says they have a record attendance this year. Bradley Manning is the Army PFC accused of the biggest leak of confidential documents in American history to WikiLeaks, which has published a lot of them online. Manning has not been convicted of any crime, but his lawyer says now that the commander of the Marine Corps jail at Quantico, Virginia, has effectively punished him. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Bradley Manning has been in custody for nearly 6 months at the Marine Corps jail at Quantico, Virginia. Recently, his attorney says he was subjected to an abuse of power when he was placed on suicide watch against the recommendation of psychiatrists for the Navy and for Manning's defense. Scott Shane has reported on Manning's imprisonment for the New York Times and on this case in general. Scott Shane, good to have you back on our program.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me, Warren.
Indeed. How was this, according to the attorney, an abuse of power, and what actually happened?
Well, as you say, Bradley Manning has been locked up. He was arrested in Kuwait back in May, and he's been at the brig, as they call it, the military jail, on the Marine base at Quantico, Virginia, since July. Until now, he's been, for most of the time, on something called Prevention of Injury Watch, which is a lower vigilance than suicide watch. But this week, for a couple of days, he was put on suicide watch. His attorney had already protested the prevention of injury watch, and some of his friends had as well, saying that they did not think he was suicidal and really did not need that kind of limitation, constant surveillance by the guards and so on. The military has said that they, you know, consult medical experts and the guards do their own observation and that it's all for his own safety and security. So they're in a bit of a standoff. He now is back on prevention of injury watch, which, again, is not as intense as the suicide watch.
Does this have to do, among other things, with what you're allowed to wear?
Yes, it it does. You know, even on Prevention of Injury Watch, he sort of strips down at night. He's given special blankets that can't be torn. The pillow is actually attached to the mattress and that sort of thing. I think it's not unusual. You know, this is not just a military thing. There are these kinds of suicide precautions in every jail, many hospitals, many psychiatric hospitals, and that sort of thing as well.
What about the psychiatrist that allegedly, according to the attorney, said they shouldn't put him on suicide watch? And is that why he was taken off?
Well, I think there is. It's very hard to get to, you know, sort of the ground truth on something like this. As you know, if psychiatrists testify at almost any criminal trial, there's sometimes a psychiatrist for the defense and one for the prosecution with very different views of the defendant. I should say that the allegations that this treatment was part of a scheme to convince Manning to testify against Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, I was not able to find any evidence to support that. I think probably what's going on here is extreme caution on the part of the military. They have had, I'm told, a suicide in the brig at Quantico in recent years, and they know that this guy is an extremely high-profile prisoner at the center of a very important case. And their view of whether he poses a danger to himself and the view of his lawyer and his friends, clearly are different.
It's being reported, and many people who are supportive of Manning and the idea that this information should have gotten out are saying that he's in solitary confinement in the first place, that the UN has shown some interest in this. What about that?
The UN has there's a UN special rapporteur, as he's called, who looks into questions of torture, and he sent a letter to the Obama administration, essentially saying, what's up with this case? I'm concerned about it, but he hasn't made his own investigation or determination. I think the other question you had was.
The other question is, why solitary confinement? How do they justify that?
Well, according to the Marines who run this brig, he's an Army private, but according to the Marines who run this brig, he's not on what they call solitary confinement. He's in, as I understand it, the media aren't allowed to visit him, but as I understand it, he's in a cell solo. He can sometimes hear other folks in adjacent cells. If there happen to be people in the cells, he's sort of a long-term guy. Most people pass through fairly quickly. He cannot see them. The guards check on him every 5 minutes. He can talk to them, but they're mostly all business. He does get out of his cell for an hour of exercise with some limitations once a day. He leaves for certain other things. He gets visitors on weekends and that sort of thing. But it's clearly a very a harsh regime, and the Marines' excuse is essentially that for people who are on maximum custody, which is what they've assigned him to, and for people on Prevention of Injury Watch, he's being treated like everybody else in those categories.
On the other hand, he hasn't been convicted of anything.
Absolutely, and there's some disagreement as to who's responsible for the slow pace at which his case is moving. Technically, he's still under medical evaluation, mental health evaluation. So it's very early in the process. When I asked the Army why it's moving so slowly, they said the defense had requested a delay back in July. And the defense has said, well, actually, it's the prosecution that's responsible for the delay.
Apparently, they're having a hard time figuring out how to charge anybody, particularly Julian Assange, the man you mentioned, who is the founder of WikiLeaks. What sort of condition is he in at the moment?
Well, he's living on he's under sort of house arrest. He has to report on his comings and goings and check in with the police station.
And he's in England.
But generally speaking, he's on a big estate outside London, and you know, he's free to write and call and you know, is doing is in much more luxurious circumstances certainly than Bradley Manning.
A certain irony to that, if in fact a conspiracy between the two of them turns out to be the charge.
That's right. I mean, I think in the view of most legal experts, the case against Bradley Manning is a much more straightforward, traditional case. If in fact the military can prove that he, you know, was the source of these classified documents, that's a rare kind of prosecution, but it's happened many times. There's never been, or it's been, I should say, it's happened several times. There's never been a successful prosecution of someone who was not in the government who received classified information and disseminated it further, which of course is something that, you know, we at the New York Times and many other news organizations
sure
do on a fairly regular basis.
Okay, Scott Shane, staff writer for the New York Times. Thanks so much for being on our program.
Thank you.
Producers of To the Point, Sonia Geis, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Andrea Brody, Katie Cooper, Gary Scott, Technical Director Mike Newport, Managing Producer Cameron Radziner. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. You can email us and you can share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/to the point, and you can check us out on Facebook. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.